The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
They were trapped in areas where they were shelling for several days before people could even get out. We know that people who were trapped in Mekele, which is a city of around 500,000, they were trapped for so many days when the fighting was going on surrounding Mekele. They did not have enough water, their internet was cut off, the telecommunication services, the telephone services were cut off. So these people did not have enough food, they did not have enough water.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 23rd, 2020. It's not something that's gotten a ton of attention amid a busy U.S. news cycle, but a whole lot has been going on in Ethiopia over the past 2 months. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who just last year won a Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts in bringing unity between Ethiopia and neighboring Eritrea, has led a military battle against domestic forces in the northern Ethiopian region of Tigray. The fighting has caused a significant displacement of people living in the region and has involved reports of atrocities. In early December, the Prime Minister claimed victory, but concerns remain about how long tensions will endure, or at least continue to simmer. It's a complicated situation with lots of different implications for the stability in East Africa and the Horn of Africa region. So, to break it all down, I talked to two experts. First, to get a sense of what's going on and how we got to this point, I talked to Emmanuel Ugunza, a reporter in East Africa for BBC News. Then, I spoke with Beza Tesfaye, the Director of Research and Learning for Migration at Mercy Corps. We spoke about the humanitarian problems implicated by the crisis. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 23rd, Conflict in Ethiopia. So, Emmanuel, there's so much going on here, and we'll dive into it all in a bit, but I think first it'd be helpful to just get some background information. So it's going to sound incredibly basic, but I suspect it'll become important context. Could you just paint a picture of the demographics of Ethiopia, particularly in terms of ethnic breakdowns, and maybe talk a bit about the country's federal structure?
Okay. So Ethiopia is a country of 110 million people, roughly, and there are around 80 ethnic communities. So there are six majority communities within Ethiopia, and that will be the Oromo, who are the largest community, and they make up around 40% of the population. And then there are the Amharas, who traditionally were the rulers of Ethiopia. If you go down the Tigray region, or the Tigray people make up around 6% of the population. And these are sort of like the big tribes if you look at the demographics of the country. And how the country is structured since 1991, when the Dag regime, this is the communist regime, was toppled, is that the country is sort of like divided into this ethnic federal states. So currently there are 10 federal states. And within those federal states, you will find sort of like the same ethnic community living in the same area. So if you go to Oromia, which is the largest area, you'll find that it's predominantly Oromo people who are predominantly living in those areas. So if you go to the north in Tigray region, which is now in focus, 6% of the population, you will find majority Tigray people in that area, and so on and so forth. If you go to the Amhara region, which is sort of like the third largest region in Ethiopia, you'll find that the Amhara people are the majority, and that's how the country is structured around.
So you mentioned the political transition in the early 90s. Talk a little bit about that. So who was in power before that, and who was in power after that? We'll get to what happened in 2018 a bit later on.
Okay, so prior to 1991, there was the Marxist regime of Mengistu Haile Mariam. So Mengistu Haile Mariam came into power after toppling the last emperor of Ethiopia, who's Haile Selassie the First. And he came into power, and for the next years, he led the country. But then in a few years before 1991, there was an uprising, popular uprising in the country, and there was a guerrilla warfare against the government of Mengistu Haile Mariam. And this, the government, at that time, the fighters were led by what is called the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF as they are commonly referred to in the country. So in 1991, they marched on into the capital, Addis Ababa, and toppled the government of Mengistu Haile Mariam. And then they set up this government, which was a coalition of different ethnic political parties, which came together, and they ruled for the next 28 years. They were the rulers of Ethiopia. They led the country, and during that time they took Ethiopia from a period of when they were suffering hunger and poverty and all that stuff, and they brought up the country to become a fast-growing economy and a force to reckon with in the Horn and East of Africa. So the predominant party within that coalition was the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, and this was led by the then strongman, Meles Zenawi. So Meles Zenawi set up the country. He charted sort of like the map for the development of Ethiopia, and he's credited so much with how the country has grown from a country that was so dependent on foreign aid and at a time when it was facing hunger in the 80s, to a country that was growing up and became sort of like a big economy, a strong economy in the Horn of Africa.
And so the reign of the ruling coalition does not last forever. So what happens to precipitate its downfall, and when does that happen?
So during that time, there were always these accusations against the government, the coalition government, that it was very strong and did not take into consideration the human rights of the Ethiopian people. And the tensions were simmering for so many years. And then it was only until 2015 that this big pressure came against the government. And the uprising began in the Oromia region, which is the largest region in Ethiopia and home to the largest ethnic community. So there was a popular uprising, and people demonstrated in the streets calling for political inclusion. They were against what they said was economic marginalization. Many of the youth who are demonstrating within the Oromia region say they did not have access to jobs. They could not access even the basic markets because they were simply not in power. And this popular uprising continued for the next 3 years until 2018, during the reign of Haile Mariam Desalegn, who was the prime minister then. And it was only in February 2018 that the Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn announced that he will be resigning because of the uprising that had taken over. There were lots of people who had been taken to the streets, hundreds of thousands of people. And he resigned. And then after he resigned, there was a sort of like a remapping of the ruling coalition. And then this is when the current Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, came into power as a reformist, and he more significantly, he came from the group, the community that had been protesting most. So he's from Oromia region. He's an Oromo. So he came into power and many people had seen that if there was an Oromo in power, then all those issues that had been bogging down the country, all this ethnic conflict that had been continuing in the country would have been sorted out. And that is why he came into power and there was so many reforms that came with him coming into power, the release of political prisoners, mostly from the Oromia region who had been in prison for long. He welcomed back exile groups like the OLF, the Oromo Liberation Front, which for years had been fighting the government, but in exile, he welcomed them back. And also he brought about all these economic reforms. The country had been for so many years, the government had had a stronghold on the economy, but he came in and said that he was willing to open up the economy to become a free market. And these are some of the changes that he brought into Ethiopia.
So there's a lot to unpack there, and I think I want to pick it apart piece by piece. But first, what was the reaction among those in Tigray to these reforms and to Abiy's transition of power? Was it sort of understanding that it's time for a change or discontent at the way he went about these reforms?
Immediately when Abiy came into power, there was a lot of discontent from the Tigray region, which was its home to, of course, the TPLF, which was within the political setup of Ethiopia, was the dominant political party in the country. When Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came into power, there was a lot of discontent because they saw him as changing radically everything that they had set up in the country. They were in charge of the economy, they were in charge politically, and with that they had control of not just the political sphere, but also the economy of the country. They were the dominant party in terms of running the country. They were the dominant force. So when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came into power, it disrupted everything that they had set up in place over the last 33 decades or so. And there was a lot of disquiet, and the government, the current government, has always accused the TPLF or the ruling party in Tigray region of instigating revolts against the government. In 2018, immediately the prime minister came into power, there was an attempt against his life. In June, I was attending that event where there were hundreds of thousands of people who had come to welcome the prime minister, and there was a grenade attack just several meters away from the prime minister's podium. And the government has always, the government of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has always insisted that this was the work of elements within the TPLF. Many months after, in October, there was hundreds of soldiers marched from their barracks to go to the prime minister's palace in what the government will later say was an attempted coup. And there was this really significant picture of the prime minister trying to calm down the soldiers. And what he did was he talked to the soldiers and he did press ups with them as a show of solidarity. So that picture really trended worldwide of this prime minister who was willing to talk to even soldiers who had tried to stage a mutiny. And again, the blame was taken of this attempted coup was on the TPLF. There were various high-ranking government officials within the TPLF who the government was looking for, claiming that they had been involved in corruption, human rights abuses. And so there was always this tension since the prime minister came into office in 2018 between the central government and the Tigray Liberation Front. And this came to a head in September of last year when the TPLF and the Tigray region announced that it will be holding its own election, the regional election. Under the constitution, they're allowed to hold elections, but the government had said because of the coronavirus, the elections which were supposed to be held this year would not be held because of COVID-19. But then the Tigray region decided that it was going to go ahead with the elections, and they went ahead with the elections despite the government saying that these elections, the regional elections, were illegal, and they elected the officials to run the Tigray region. And the government then saw this as a rebellion. And since then, there has been this really intense confrontation between the central government and the Tigray region.
So we'll come back to that conflict in a sec, but I do think one thing that certainly gets a lot of attention in English language and American news media is that in his early days, Abiy really had this public image as a reformer, as someone who was going to bring about a new path for Ethiopia. Maybe to some extent that was deserved. And then he wins the Nobel Peace Prize. Talk a little bit about why did he win that prize, and what was, at the peak of his public image, what was the perception of Abiy?
So Abiy Ahmed won the Nobel Peace Prize because of ending this long war with neighboring Eritrea. Eritrea was once a part of Ethiopia, and then they seceded and became an independent country. So for the next 20 years, there was a state of no peace, no war between the two countries. And if you go back during that war between Eritrea and Ethiopia, the border dispute, hundreds of thousands of people died. So you had almost communities, families that were the same. Overnight, they were separated. And for a long time, the borders were closed until Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came into power. And when he came into power, one of the first things he said was, we want peace with our Eritrean brothers who share the same, along the border, they share the same language, they share the same culture, and they were at some time in the same country. So ending that dispute, which had been going on, one of the longest running conflicts in Africa, ending that conflict is what earned Abiy Ahmed the Nobel Peace Prize. But immediately he came into power, months after, there were already these tensions that were going on because the province that borders Eritrea is Tigray province. And so internally, when Ethiopia has all these problems with the Tigray region, and Tigray region has historically had a problem with Eritrea, then these tensions, even despite the peace deal that Abiy Ahmed had signed with Eritrea, there were always this tension that was going on. In terms of internally, when he came into power, Abiy Ahmed was enjoying massive support. Probably all the country opinion polls were showing that he had massive support across the country, not just from his home area in Oromia region, but across, even in Tigray region, he was enjoying massive support because he came in and immediately brought all these reforms that all the Ethiopians had been yearning for years during the monarchy areas, when the era of the monarchies, the kings, and then came into the EPRDF government over the last 30 years or so, when they were led by strongmen. People had been yearning for change, and Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came in and read the mood of the country, and he gave the people what they wanted to see, what they had yearned for so many years. But then also, on the flip side, is that all these freedoms that he had brought also brought about all these ethnic tensions, because for so many years, the government that had been in place had sort of like clamped down on dissent. No one could speak about issues about land or the border issues that were constantly in Ethiopia. But when Abiy came in and he allowed people to have a voice, then all this tension that had been there throughout the country, people began to speak openly about it. And then it also turned into conflict because people were more bold to speak about the disputes about the borders and everything. And this turned quickly into ethnic tension. That's why in between 2018 and 2019, we saw massive internal displacement in Ethiopia. At the peak, there were around 2 million people who were displaced within Ethiopia itself. And this became probably the highest number of internally displaced people in the world. And you could compare it to the likes of Syria or Yemen. So this was very serious. And it was because of the freedom that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed had brought into the country. And then if you again look at it critically, he didn't address some of those issues which had been simmering for so many years, particularly the ethnic tensions. And these are what now have come to the fore that we see even in the conflict, that the war that has been going on in the north of the country, it's taking an ethnic dimension because all these issues which were simmering for so many years, the Prime Minister simply did not have enough time to deal with them.
So there is that conflict in Tigray going on now. Talk a little bit about just the basics. Who is fighting who? So is it's the National Army fighting, is it components of the TPLF?
Yes. So the government, the Ethiopian National Defense Force, went into Tigray region beginning of November 3rd. And they simply say that they wanted to take out the elements, the TPLF elements. And so TPLF is the ruling party within the Tigray region, which is in the north. And the prime minister at that time said that this war will be very precise. It was simply going in, taking out the TPLF leadership and then going out. Because at that time, the government claimed that the TPLF and the forces of TPLF had attacked a military base in the north of the country. So the significance is that because of the long-standing war between Eritrea and Ethiopia, this base, military base in the north, was heavily funded. It was heavily equipped. It was one of the most advanced military bases in Ethiopia. So when the TPLF forces attacked the military base, the government said that this was an act of treason. And that is why the Ethiopian National Defense Force was sent to the north to try and, first of all, take out the TPLF leadership and then take control of this very important military base. We do know that because of the long-standing war in Ethiopia between Ethiopia and Eritrea, the TPLF and also the Tigray region has had a very strong army. So conservative figures, analysts believe that the military in the north of the country numbers are around 250,000 people. So this military of the Tigray region was supported by militia forces within the Tigray region. And they have been fighting against the military, the national army, since the 3rd of November. And even now, when the government has declared that the war has ended and it was now a police operation to try and arrest the TPLF leaders, we do know that there are several areas where fighting is still continuing. Even this week, there have been reports of heavy bombardment in areas not just far away from the capital of Tigray region, which is Mekele. So fighting is indeed continuing. And the government, despite saying that it is in control, we do know that it is facing heavy fighting in some of the areas within Tigray region.
In early December, there was the transition where the government claims that they've retaken the capital of Tigray. But before that, talk a little about what the fighting was like. Was it sort of like a guerrilla style conflict, a sort of counterinsurgency? What did it look like on the ground, to the best that you know?
During that time, I have to mention that there were no comms. The internet and telephone communication was completely cut off for several weeks between November and December. There was very little information coming out of Tigray region. But what we know from some of the refugees who fled from Ethiopia into Sudan is that this was an all-out open war. We had bombardment, missile attacks in several places of in several towns of Tigray, in places like Shire and Mekele itself. We know there was heavy shelling, so this was an outright war. But then when the government said that it had captured Mekele, which in some ways was very symbolic in terms of saying that they have captured the capital of the TPLF and the TPLF is no longer a threat. But we know that TPLF retreated into the mountains. This is an area that they know very well, because if you look at the topography of the area of the north of Ethiopia, it's very mountainous. And so these soldiers who have fought not just during the war with the Eritrea, they've managed to fight off in the 1800s when they fought the Italians who were trying to colonize Ethiopia. They succeeded, the TPLF fighters, the fighters from Tigray managed to fight the Italians because they were very conversant with their topography. And so we know that when the government claimed that they had retaken Mekele, fighters from TPLF retreated into the mountains, into the forest, and they've been sort of like waging this counterinsurgency, guerrilla type of fight against the government. We saw even days after the government said that it had retaken Mekele, they were able to fire missiles into the neighboring region of Amhara and also destroying the airport. They also fired missiles again twice into neighboring Eritrea. So they are still a force to reckon with, despite all these government assurances to the Ethiopians that everything is under control.
And so there have been various different reports. I know you mentioned it's hard to get concrete information of atrocities taking place in from both sides involved in the conflict. Could you talk a bit about what the particular flashpoints there have been?
Yes. So the earliest information that came out was a massacre that happened in a place called Maikadra. So Maikadra is in Tigray region. And these human rights organizations, both within Ethiopia and the likes of Amnesty International and Transparency International, have all said, and the United Nations have all blamed the attack that happened in Maikadra on TPLF militia. So what we know is that the TPLF militia attacked people who were seen as not being native of the area. And majority of those people who were killed from the Amhara group, which is a neighboring region to Tigray region. And around 600 or so people were killed. Thousands of people were displaced. And the extent, the information that all those people who fled from Maikadra have been giving out to media and to aid agencies is that this was a really horrid massacre. You know, people were rounded up in several villages and shot at and run over by vehicles, hanged, burnt in their houses. So it was a really horrific massacre that happened in Maikadra. But we've also had in some of the areas that the government has been accused of going into some of the areas, particularly those which are bordering Eritrea, and taking out and injuring and killing civilians. We do know that the Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has been very categorical in saying that there were no civilians who've been killed. But we've heard from doctors who have been in those areas who are saying that they were trapped in areas where they were shelling for several days before people could even get out. We know that people who were trapped in Mekele, which is a city of around 500,000, they were trapped for so many days when the fighting was going on surrounding Mekele. They did not have enough water. Their internet was cut off. The telecommunication services, the telephone services were cut off. So these people did not have enough food. They did not have enough water. And we also know that the areas around Tigray are home to thousands, around 120,000 Eritrean refugees who've been living in the refugee camps for maybe 20 or so years. And the United Nations did say that they are really concerned that during the period between November 3rd and into coming into December, they were not able to access the refugee camps. So those refugees who had been in those camps during this period of war did not have access to any humanitarian assistance, while they had depended solely on aid agencies for basic food, water, and everything. So they were not able to access those facilities. So we do know that the humanitarian crisis that was created by this month or so of war between the TPLF forces and the Ethiopian Defense Forces was really huge.
And so now that Abiy Ahmed has sort of at least nominally claimed that the war on the ground is over, is it the case that, as he says, that this is sort of going to resolve itself reasonably quickly? Or is it, I've seen at least some analysts suggest that there's really no clear end game here. This could drag on in a sort of guerrilla war form or in all sorts of different senses for a pretty long time. Do you have a sense of what the plausible end outcomes here are?
It's really difficult to say what the end game here is. Like all analysts who have been following Ethiopia for long do appreciate and do say is that this will go on for a very long time. The Prime Minister, the government of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has even gone ahead this week and announced that they will be giving out a prize in dollars, which is around $280,000, around $300,000 for anyone who has information on any of the TPLF leaders. So you're talking about a list of more than 100 high profile leaders who are being sort of sought by the Ethiopian authorities because they are seen as to have led this rebellion. And we do know that they have gone, some of them have been intercepted in neighboring countries like Sudan, just across the border. Some of them are believed to be hiding out in the mountains and in the forest. So we do know that this will take a long time unless the government does agree to sit down and talk with the TPLF leadership. The likes of the United Nations, the African Union, many African countries, including Kenya itself, Uganda, have all asked Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to sit down and talk to the TPLF leadership in a bid to try and end this conflict that is ongoing. But the government has simply said that it is not willing to talk to TPLF until they arrest the masterminds of this rebellion that they call a threat to their own sovereignty. So it doesn't look like, with all the sides, the government on one side saying that it is not going to negotiate with the TPLF, and TPLF saying that this is not a defeat. Yes, they've taken over all some of our major cities, but we've gone to the mountains. It does seem that this will go on for quite a while.
And what is this meant for the Prime Minister? So maybe this is the type of thing that sort of solidifies his rule in one way or another. Maybe it's the type of thing that, you know, people are seeing that this is how he's prepared to deal with internal strife in the country. And it's really causes, you know, a crisis of confidence in his leadership. It's really hard to tell, I'm sure, but do we have a sense of what this has meant for Abiy's standing in the country?
There is no doubt that this has really split the country because he still enjoys massive support, not just from his home base, but across Ethiopia. He still has those people who really support him and say that he was right in trying to root out the TPLF leadership, who have been accused of carrying out several attacks which have been going on in Ethiopia internally. But he's also lost a massive base of people who had so much hope in him, people who saw him as a reformist, people who saw him as bringing a new change for Ethiopia. But then they see how he has dealt with the Tigray crisis, and they're not really happy because they say it's an example of how he will deal with any other region that does not subscribe to his ethos or his way of working. So the country is really, really split in between. And remember that the country will be going, it was supposed to hold an election this year. They've now announced that the election will be held in 2021, around June. All analysts believe that if things stay the same and the country does hold an election, things will really go badly because of all these ethnic tensions have not been resolved, and then the country will be going into an election. But more significantly is that many people do not believe that if an election was held today, the Prime Minister will go back into office. So this has really dented his image that made him such a big hit in the West and also won him a Nobel. Within the country, he's facing a serious challenge.
And then there's this sort of regional side of things. So you have a pretty good sense of what is going on, not just in Ethiopia, but also in the broader regions. That's, you know, Somalia, Sudan, South Sudan, Kenya. And there's often this, at least as far as I've seen among people that study East Africa and the Horn of Africa, the sense that Ethiopia, the stability of Ethiopia has a pretty big impact on the stability of the region. And I've seen people concerned that, you know, what's happened in Tigray and what's happening with Abiy Ahmed is a real threat to regional stability. I wonder what you'd say to that and sort of walk me through what the regional implications of all of this have been, both for Eritrea, but also for other countries that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet.
Yes, indeed. So when Ethiopia is now embroiled with its what they call their own internal affairs, with the crisis in the north of the country, we do know that there are all these accusations that Eritrean forces are now actively involved in the conflict in Ethiopia. We've heard from US diplomats from the UK who all say that they believe that Eritrea is actively the Eritrean forces are actively involved fighting alongside the Ethiopian forces of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. So that in sense also makes the peace deal that Eritrea and Ethiopia signed puts it on a balance, because after the peace deal was signed in 2018, everyone expected that both countries would now focus on development and ending this state of war that had been there for 20 years. And this complicates that peace deal. If you look at the influence that Ethiopia has on countries like Somalia and Djibouti, South Sudan and Sudan, it's huge. Ethiopia is one of the key players in terms of the fight against terrorism in the Eastern Horn of Africa. They have lots of troops who are part of the African Union forces in Somalia. They have peacekeepers in South Sudan, which is the world's youngest nation. And their influence is really huge. And when now they have to deal with all these internal conflicts, it takes away the focus from the fight against terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab. And we've seen that even within the last few weeks when this conflict within Ethiopia has been going on, Al-Shabaab has been able to mount several attacks within Somalia. And this is some of the sectors where Al-Shabaab has hit, sectors within Somalia where Ethiopian peacekeepers were. So this will definitely have a huge impact on the fight against terrorism in the Eastern Horn of Africa. Countries like Kenya, which are big partners with Ethiopia, are now overwhelmed because of the shift of focus within Ethiopia from the larger regional issues to now their internal affairs. So this will definitely have a huge impact. And even if you're just speaking about the numbers of people who have been fleeing from the Tigray region going into Sudan. Sudan is a country that is just trying to recover from conflict, years of misrule by former President Omar al-Bashir. And now they are burdened with thousands of refugees who've come in all of a sudden to a country that is not even able to take care of them. So this will have repercussions, and it is the repercussions and the effects are being seen already.
And that is all I have. Emmanuel, thank you so much. That was really helpful.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, here's my conversation with Beza Tesfaye of Mercy Corps. We talked about the humanitarian crisis in Ethiopia. It's a complicated situation, one that combines longstanding troubles with newer issues. One quick note, after I spoke with Beza, the situation on the ground actually improved in some important ways. Aid has begun to come into the country, with both food aid and medical supplies making its way in, and these materials have managed to even reach refugees in northern Tigray. And on the telecommunications side, things have also improved. In parts of Tigray, mostly western Tigray and the capital Mekele, phone lines have been restored, although the internet remains dark in the region. It's still a really great conversation about the humanitarian challenges and the wide-ranging impacts of the current crisis. I hope you enjoy. So before we get into sort of talking about the impact of the recent conflict on humanitarian conditions in the country, I wonder if you could just give us a bit of background. So what was the humanitarian situation in Ethiopia like before all this picked up? Because I know, I mean, among other things, there's a really significant amount of refugees within the country, but there's, I know there's lots to talk about.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's always useful to put things in a bit of a context. So as you mentioned, Ethiopia has been hosting a large number of refugees. I think, in fact, the latest numbers I saw estimated that there were about 1 million refugees in Ethiopia. And most of those refugees tend to be from South Sudan, and they're hosted in the western part of Ethiopia. There are also about 100,000 Eritrean refugees in Tigray in the north, and they've been there for many years. And then in the eastern part of Ethiopia, there are a large number of Somali refugees as well. I think this fact kind of reflects something important to know about the context, which is that Ethiopia over the past couple of decades has really been a sort of beacon of stability in the broader Horn of Africa region. While you've had ongoing conflict in Somalia. Of course, you've had the situation in South Sudan, and Eritrea has also had its own internal challenges. Ethiopia, for the most part, over the past couple of decades, has been largely stable and has also been experiencing rapid economic growth, double-digit economic growth over the past couple of decades, and in fact was said to be on its way of becoming a middle-income country by 2025. So you've seen Ethiopia sort of hosting, for the most part, more refugees over the past few years than it was, let's say, exporting to other countries. That said, though, there are also humanitarian concerns and challenges in Ethiopia. And before the conflict in Tigray erupted, there were approximately 15 million people in Ethiopia that were receiving humanitarian assistance. And about 8 million of those people were receiving food aid because they were severely food insecure. So there are still serious humanitarian challenges. And I think they stem from a few things. The first is that Ethiopia is very vulnerable to climatic disasters and is also facing the effects of slow onset climate change. So rising temperatures, increasingly sporadic rainfall, things like that have led to humanitarian crises. In fact, this last year, there were unusually heavy rains that led to flooding in some parts of the country that led to a great deal of displacement. On top of that, this year has also been, I think, uniquely difficult because there's also the desert locust outbreak that has been affecting the broader Horn of Africa region. But that has been devastating to Ethiopia. It's been the worst locust outbreak in almost 25 years, has led to the destruction of hundreds of square miles of pasture and cropland. And that has pushed a number of people into food insecurity. So you have these challenges. And of course, on top of all of that, you also have Ethiopia dealing with the COVID-19 situation. Even though the cases are not as high as here in the U.S., the sort of the restrictions on movement have had a disruptive effect on the markets and growth. It's also had an effect on remittances because people are not able to migrate and send money back home. So all of these things have really compounded the sort of the humanitarian situation in the past year, even though, relatively speaking, Ethiopia was in a very stable and healthy economic and political situation over the past couple of decades.
And you mentioned that there have been sort of longstanding programs within the country to get aid to those in need. Are those largely from sort of nation states like the U.S. or from international organizations? And has it been, historically at least, has it been relatively easy to get those in need, the sort of help they need?
There have been both. There are bilateral donors like the U.S. government. It's one of the largest, if not the largest donor, I think, to Ethiopia, provides huge amounts of humanitarian assistance. And then there's also international organizations like the UN that provide that support. Your question, is it easy to get aid to groups? I think kind of depends how far back you're looking historically. I think Ethiopia in the 1980s, which is what a lot of people are most familiar with when thinking about Ethiopia, the famine in the 80s, at that time, aid was withheld largely for political reasons. And people, I think up to 1 million people in the 1980s actually starved in the context of a drought that then led to a famine because aid was withheld. So you've had that in the past, but in the past 2 decades and in the situation today, it's really not the case that aid tends to be withheld and is difficult to reach people in the country. In fact, just to give you another example, in 2015, Ethiopia faced what was considered to be one of the worst droughts in many decades. And there was a great deal of concern at that point from humanitarian donors that this could cause another famine like what we saw in the 1980s. But that was largely averted. In fact, there was no famine. And this was because there was a very good and concerted effort to provide aid to millions of people that were affected by the drought during that time. So because of the political stability Ethiopia has been experiencing, I think, we don't see these famines as we saw in the past. And it is more and more possible and easy to get aid to people in need of it.
Okay, so now things change a little bit. There's conflict in the country, particularly in the north. Sort of walk me through what the impact of the most recent conflict has been on the humanitarian situation. Has it sort of been the case that things have slowly gotten worse, or have there been real particular points where the situation is made more dire?
Well, I think it's kind of difficult to say. I mean, I'm not sure if you're aware, but there is somewhat of a lack of information coming out of Tigray, the region that's been affected by this, because there's essentially been a communications blackout. Phone lines have been out of service. Internet has been shut off as well. So it's hard to really assess the full humanitarian toll, especially in that region. But we know certain things. For example, we know that at one point, banks were closed, so people were not able to access financial services within the region. We know that essential supplies, such as fuel for generators and transportation, were not making it into the region. And as I mentioned, there was lack of communications. So obviously, people are very concerned about their loved ones that live in Tigray. Transportation along major roads and through airports were also largely impeded. So as with any sort of conflict, you know, the humanitarian concerns increase because of things like this. And that's not even to mention the potential casualties, displacement, loss of life, and so on that have occurred, which we don't really know the full scope of as of yet. So it's hard to say, but, you know, we are sort of concerned about people that are within the region. But, you know, the way things have progressed, I think there was an expectation that it would be worse than it is. The fighting officially, according to the government, came to an end a couple of weeks ago when they called off the military operation in the region. So we are hopeful that this will lead to less insecurity, more humanitarian access, and hopefully a complete cessation of the hostilities in the region.
And so there has been some news that there are real significant numbers of people, sort of inconclusive how many, who have fled to neighboring regions. So, you know, going to Sudan or going to other countries. Could you give a sense of what, it's obviously hard to say for certain, but for those who are fleeing conflict, where have they tended to go?
So there are two things. There are people that flee outside of Ethiopia, and then those that are internally displaced. We have a better sense of the refugees or those that flee Ethiopia. And so far, about 50,000 people have left Ethiopia and moved to eastern Sudan. There are some refugee camps there. One that we work in is called Umra Kuba Refugee Camp, and it's about 80 kilometers from the Ethiopia-Sudan border. And so far, you know, a large number of refugees have been relocated there. In terms of internal displacement, as I mentioned, it's unclear. My organization, Mercy Corps, is working to assess the needs of potential internally displaced people in neighboring regions of Ethiopia. So adjacent to Tigray, there are two regions. One is called Amara region and the other one is called Afar. And we're trying to see if we can help IDPs that are moving to those regions. But so far, the numbers have been really low. So this leads us to believe that a lot of people are internally displaced within the Tigray region itself. But as I mentioned, there hasn't been a lot of information coming out about the exact numbers, and there hasn't been access for humanitarian agencies into that region so far.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear you talk a little bit more about that last point. So there's been some news that it, as you said, it's really quite difficult for humanitarian agencies, whoever they may be, to get access to what's happening in Tigray. Could you just explain that a little bit? Talk about what the sort of the struggles have been?
Well, I think first, because there was fighting between the Ethiopian National Defense Forces and then the forces loyal to the regional government, there was a sense of insecurity, which made it difficult for anyone to travel to that region. So humanitarian agencies especially weren't able to go in and provide relief. So in recent weeks, there have been discussions and negotiations between the UN and the government of Ethiopia of enabling access to humanitarian agencies. Now, as I mentioned, that the military operation is officially over, this means that the government is going to allow agencies to move into that region itself. So there have been some commitments in this regard, but it hasn't actually materialized into access so far, complete access for agencies like ours. But I am hopeful that, you know, these indications, that the fact that the fighting is decreasing and insecurity is hopefully decreasing as well, will enable organizations to actually provide assistance in that region where, again, we believe a lot of people are internally displaced.
So it's really hard to say for certain, but do you have a sense that the refugee infrastructure, both so in neighboring countries and then also the humanitarian infrastructure to deal with internally displaced people within the country, is it suited to deal with the huge sort of influx of newcomers that might come as the effects of the conflict are sort of realized?
The majority of refugees, as I mentioned so far, have been moving into Sudan, and the Sudanese government has been extremely generous, I think, to host these refugees. You know, that country itself is going through a political transition, and they've also had economic challenges over the past few years, but they've welcomed these refugees. So that's a great thing, but I think this can potentially add a strain to that situation. So it's really important for international donors to really step in and provide the funding and assistance that is needed for refugees in Sudan. We are working in one of the refugee camps in Sudan. It's called Umra Kuba. And this was a camp that was actually set up in the 1980s to host Ethiopian refugees that were fleeing the famine in the 1980s. So it does have, you know, existing infrastructure, but the camp has been closed since 2000. So a lot of the buildings are dilapidated, but, you know, it is a place where agencies have been able to go in and operate. I think one of the challenges now is that, you know, that camp now has about 12,000 refugees, and it was advised to not host more than 10,000 refugees. So I think there have been discussions in terms of expanding that camp, or potentially finding new areas for relocating refugees, especially if the situation is protracted and the flows of refugees increase over the next few weeks.
Yeah, and so there's a lot going on in the country and in the refugee camps, but what do you see as the most pressing humanitarian need? So if you know, you had to concentrate resources on a few things, what would they be?
Well, I think from where we sit, what we're doing right now in Umra Kuba is we're providing health services to people that have been arriving from Tigray. Mind you, a lot of these people left without anything. They, you know, fled conflict that came about somewhat unexpectedly. So they're really in desperate need. And we've been mostly providing healthcare, and many of our clients are women and children. A lot of them come with largely treatable illnesses, such as acute diarrhea, respiratory infections, or malaria. So as long as we can provide them with medicine and a place to recover, I think, you know, we're able to support their needs. I think one concern, of course, is that in a refugee camp, a densely populated area like this without proper infrastructure, there is potential for disease to spread. And of course, in the context of the COVID-19 situation, there is, you know, a high risk of a disease outbreak or infections. So ensuring that people have access to clean water and sanitary and hygiene services is also important. And we're working to provide those things. So, I mean, those are some of the specific areas that we're working on. I would say in addition to that, maybe pressing needs now, as I mentioned, is just being able to access the region in Tigray and understand the full extent of the needs there. Prior to the conflict, there were already a large number of people that were reliant on food aid. And as I mentioned, there were, you know, up to 100,000 Eritrean refugees in Tigray. So we're extremely concerned about the well-being of these individuals, because aid supplies haven't been delivered in almost a month to the region itself. So I would say the access issues is really of concern right now.
And we'll end on this note, but what do you see as the role of international partners in this being? If you could make a request of foreign governments, what would the most impactful thing for them to do be?
On the humanitarian side, I think, as I mentioned, helping agencies gain access to affected communities. There are commitments, as I mentioned, the UN and the federal government have reached an agreement on this recently, but that has been somewhat slow to materialize. But ensuring that, you know, this is possible soon and holding parties accountable to those commitments is really critical. I guess in addition to that, when we start to understand the full scope of this crisis, ensuring that there's sufficient funding and support to meet those needs, I think is going to be important. You know, this has been a challenging year for all of us, and we've seen budgets cut left and right with all of the competing priorities and challenges that, you know, everyone has been facing. But I think responding to these humanitarian needs is really going to be urgent for Ethiopia to sort of move forward with its path towards progress and development from this conflict. And I think it's going to be important also to the broader region. So ensuring that funding is available when we have the ability to access the area is also going to be important.
And that is all I have. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jacob.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Your audio engineer this week was Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Pachihau, and your music is performed, as always, by Sophia Yam. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts, and share us, whether it's on Twitter, on Facebook, or wherever else. And as always, thanks so much for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.